Support for the Marketplace Money podcast provided by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, providing the financial expertise that helps both our members and our communities thrive. Let's thrive on the web at thrivent.com.
Hi, I'm Tess Vigeland. Hate your job? Not if you work with this woman.
Employees feel a greater sense of loyalty to the company.
That's Bet Franzone of American Express. She says her company provides a perk that makes workers happy. So happy, in fact, that
employees feel a greater sense of loyalty to the company.
What benefit makes employees pledge allegiance to Amex? Is it A, housing assistance? Lots of folks prefer cheap rent to a raise. Or are we talking B, a sabbatical? Every Amexer gets a two-month leave after 10 years. Or perhaps workers appreciate C, profit sharing. You know that fee you pay when you use your Amex card overseas? A few cents of that goes to folks like Miss Franzone. Don't know the answer? Stick around. It's coming up on this week's Marketplace Money from American Public Media.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, this is Marketplace Money.
TV shows go on hiatus. Kids get 3 months off from school. Athletes take half the year to recharge. All the rest of us can do is pine for a sabbatical. I'm Tess Vigeland. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, working to provide tools and expertise to help you meet your retirement goals and ultimately thrive in retirement. Let's thrive on the web at thrivent.com/retirement.
You know how when vacation time is approaching, you start thinking about it a lot? That's me. I'm heading out in about a week. It'll be great, but I know when I get back, it won't have been enough. I'll think to myself, oh, if only I could take off a month or two and still get paid. It happens in Europe. And surprise, it does happen here, and not only to college professors. Marketplace's Jeff Tyler takes a look at one of the best occupational perks going, the sabbatical.
Call it the 7-year stretch. Every 7 years, employees at Intel get 8 weeks of paid time off. Diana Igusa spent her sabbatical in the Caribbean.
My husband and I rented a cabin on the beach in St. Croix in the U.S. Virgin Islands, and we basically spent a month there just kind of hanging out and being beach bums.
Kicking back in the Caribbean was Igusa's antidote for excessive responsibility. The sabbatical is like a buffer against burnout.
I did a lot of snorkeling, and we just kind of got to know the local routine. There was a place called the Rainbow Beach Bar. Everybody went there to watch the sunset.
Now, 7 years later, Igusa has an infant and a toddler.
Hey, look who I found. Who's that?
Tiger.
She's just about to start her second paid sabbatical.
Mostly this time what I'm doing is spending more time this summer with my boys and having some family time.
Unfortunately, companies like Intel are in the minority. According to a report by the Society for Human Resource Management, only 4% of companies surveyed offered paid sabbaticals. Another 16% offer them without pay. Some companies place restrictions on what employees do during their sabbaticals. After working for American Express for 10 years, workers can take off between 1 and 6 months to do volunteer work. One employee mentored low-income children through an arts program. Bette Franzone is a spokesperson for American Express.
We know that volunteering is very important to our employees. We feel as a company that it's very important to give back to the community as well.
But it's not just about altruism. Working with charities, volunteers often learn new management skills. And Franzone says the program helps deter workers from quitting.
Employees do return to the company feeling, you know, more rejuvenated and even feel a greater sense of loyalty to the company.
That was the case for Diana Igusa. After decompressing in the Virgin Islands, she says she returned to her job in human resources at Intel feeling reinvigorated.
It was kind of a thing where I appreciated my job more because of that experience.
Some workers find that a time out from the daily grind allows them to see their work with fresh eyes or approach it from a new angle. But if your company hasn't yet come to appreciate the value of a sabbatical, it's up to you to persuade your boss. Charlotte Anderson is the president of a human resources consulting firm called Amethyst and Iris. She suggests approaching the subject as a bargaining tool. If you can't negotiate a raise, she says, consider asking for a sabbatical.
I think it's really a very savvy move, because a couple of the concerns employers have about salary increases, number one is that they compound, and the value of the sabbatical doesn't compound. It's a one-time offering.
To sell the idea, try to anticipate your employer's needs. Anderson says you should come up with a plan for who will cover for you while you're away, so your absence won't create more stress.
A good employee, particularly a good manager, will have taken stages to make his or her absence less impactful.
Of course, some employees leave and never come back. They take time off to figure out what to do for their next career. With any luck, it will include perks like an 8-week paid sabbatical. Dreaming of tropical beaches from a landlocked cubicle, I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace Money.
Funny, I'm having that same dream, Jeff. Have you left the rat race for a time? Tell us about your sabbatical. Visit our website, marketplace.org, and click on Contact.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, working to provide tools and expertise to help you meet your retirement goals and ultimately thrive in retirement. Let's thrive. On the web at thrivent.com/retirement. And by the NASD Investor Education Foundation, helping inform today's investor through innovative grant-making and educational funding. Online at nasdfoundation.org.
The automated teller machine celebrated its 40th birthday this week. With any luck, it gave itself an extra $20 bill. Most of us are pretty comfortable with the U.S. banking system. We learned about it in middle school or junior high home ec, how to write a check, track deposits and withdrawals. And over the years, we've become pretty comfortable with cash machines and online banking. But for many Latino immigrant families, the system remains a mystery. So a program in Omaha, Nebraska is teaching students to teach home ec to their parents. From Nebraska Public Radio, Avishay Artsy reports.
It's a Thursday evening. Parents mill around the lobby of R.M. Mars Magnet Center, a middle school in South Omaha. It's an area that's predominantly Latino, and the students have invited their parents so they can teach them how to be better financial managers.
Hello.
What is this?
Okay, this is a brochure that tells you what's going on tonight.
Erin Roos, an economics teacher at R.M. Mars, greets parents with a list of workshops on topics like budgeting, taxes, and online banking.
These are 7th and 8th grade students are putting on these presentations tonight. We're the only junior academy of finance in the nation, and we're really excited about this because our kids are learning about things that students in other junior highs aren't exposed to.
We will show you how to be more comfortable with using an online banking account.
12-year-old Aaron Alvarez helps lead one of the workshops. His mother, Nora Chavez, says she's glad her son has learned about managing money and can tell her how.
Because we didn't know about the banking online, about the things like credit cards, interest, and we just were, you know, borrowing money and doing things that we made a lot of mistakes by didn't paying attention at the interest and things like that.
Chavez says now her son won't make the same mistakes she did. A third of U.S.-born Hispanic residents and over half of all Mexican immigrants lack bank accounts, according to the 2000 census. Latinos also have lower home ownership rates and less access to brokerage services. Sasha Chavez teaches social studies at the school.
The Latino community is a great sleeping giant. It's been said time and time again, and the buying power is there, but I just sometimes wonder if there's enough knowledge about how to spend wisely and how people can make more of their money.
U.S. Hispanic purchasing power has surged to nearly $700 billion and could reach $1 trillion by 2010. Chavez says these students can help their parents take the lead in the global marketplace, but not until they learn who to trust with their money.
There's stores like Souls and Jewelry Loan, Easy Money, and Payday Express. And there's a map right here, is Easy Money, Chicken Cash in South Omaha.
Carlos Moscoso projects a map onto the wall of what he calls local predatory lenders that charge as much as 28% monthly interest rates. This 12-year-old's parents, Santiago Garcia and Dora Moscoso, say the language barrier keeps many Latinos from going to banks.
The Latinos, we need more information.
Spanish.
Yeah, and the Spanish. Uh-huh.
While about two-thirds of the students at RMRs are Latino, school principal Pam Cohn says how to handle things like credit card offers and opening a bank account is information that all kids need to know. In Omaha, Nebraska, I'm Avishai Artsy for Marketplace Money.
And this is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. The Federal Reserve Open Market Committee met this week. They decided to leave the benchmark federal funds rate right where it was at 5.25%. So you say, what exactly is the federal funds rate? We asked some folks on the street outside the Fed meeting in Washington for a definition.
Federal funds rate? I'm not really sure how to answer that one.
I believe it's 5.25%.
I don't know what it does, except that it probably takes my money.
I'm thinking they're talking about short-term interest rates that affect car loan or whatever.
My lack of knowledge on this issue would be an indication that I need to take some sort of fiscal policy course.
Back to school? That may be true, but here at Marketplace Money, we never stop learning. Grab a number two pencil, because summer school's in session. And this week, Greg McBride of Bankrate.com helps us out with the federal funds rate.
The federal funds rate is the rate that banks pay to borrow from each other in the overnight market. But more important than that, it's an important benchmark for interest rates of all different types that impact both businesses and consumers. Banks have a requirement to keep a certain level of reserves depending upon how many deposits they've accumulated in all of their branches. Now, that requirement changes from day to day as the amount of deposits that they have in their bank change from day to day. Some days banks might be a little short. Some days banks may have a little excess in reserves than they need. They don't want this money to sit idle. So what they do is if they have an excess, they'll lend it to another bank who might be short for the day. The next day, it could be the other way around. That they're a little short, they need to borrow from another bank. The federal funds rate is the rate that banks are paying each other to borrow that money on a daily basis. The rate that banks pay is important because it affects the rate that we pay. So when the federal funds rate goes up, banks pass along that higher cost to businesses and consumers in the form of the prime rate. So if the federal funds rate goes up by a quarter of a percentage point, you'll see the prime rate move up by also a quarter of a percentage point. And what this does is this means that any instrument tied to that prime rate, such as a credit card, a home equity line of credit, all of those rates would go up by a similar amount. When the Federal Reserve raises interest rates, they're talking about that federal funds rate. And what they're really doing is adjusting the target rate that banks would have to pay each other to borrow or lend money on an overnight basis.
Our teacher is Greg McBride of Bankrate.com. More summer school next week when we tackle earnings. What happens when a timeshare turns into a shared money pit? Chris digs us out in the mailbag. And here's a lawyer whose work crosses borders.
Immigration law hasn't changed at all after September 11. What's changed is the policies. Individuals from certain countries have a more difficult time.
A day in the work life of an immigration attorney. It's all coming up on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Tessa Meglund. This week, Congress debated an immigration reform bill again, and they sent it packing again. The bill would have effectively paved the way for millions of illegal immigrants in the U.S. to become legal. While the issue continues to fester on Capitol Hill and along the campaign trail, newcomers to this country are earning their stripes the old-fashioned way. On this week's A Day in the Work Life, we aspire to citizenship with an immigration attorney.
Hi.
I'm from Canada, and I just married a U.S. citizen, and I'd like to know what my options are for immigration.
My name is Yvette Lopez Cooper. I am 32 years old, and I practice immigration law. An immigration attorney helps individuals who are seeking to regularize their status, whether that means to gain permanent resident status, to obtain a temporary worker's visa, or to gain United States citizenship. My father, who's from El Salvador, fled the Honduras-El Salvador soccer war in 1969. My mother's from Mexico. I think because of my parents' immigrant background, because of my experience in living in a foreign country, it has helped me understand certain clients, especially my Spanish-speaking clients, a little bit better. So yes, having lived in South America, it's helped me with the language and the culture of certain clients. Definitely that helps. Most people think that immigration law has changed drastically after September 11th. That is not necessarily the case. Immigration law hasn't changed at all after September 11th. What's changed is the policies. Individuals from certain countries have a more difficult time gaining permanent resident status or U.S. citizenship status. There's more security checks that are being done now in immigration cases. And that process takes longer, mostly because it's caught up in the bureaucratic system. In some cases, this means 15 years wait, if not longer, for certain countries. Some of my most difficult cases involve cases that deal with humanitarian issues. For example, battered immigrant women cases, asylum cases. Many times these are cases that involve life-threatening situations. And those cases are difficult because it's hard not to take those issues personally. Many of these cases I represent on pro bono basis. I would say probably the majority of them. It's hard to say no to someone who has been persecuted. An immigration lawyer's salary would vary as a solo practitioner, whether they have their own business or whether they're working for a large firm or working for the government. Someone generally in my position would make around $75,000 to $85,000 a year. I had a client who recently became a citizen. He's 77 years old from Peru. And he came to the United States, didn't speak a word of Spanish, actually, because he spoke the indigenous language, learned Spanish first because he was exposed to a lot of Spanish-speaking individuals, and then learned English. Recently, at 77 years old, passed his naturalization exam. He was so thrilled when he got to vote last year.
A Day in the Work Life was produced by Klaus Andresen.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, working to provide tools and expertise to help you meet your retirement goals and ultimately thrive in retirement. Let's thrive. On the web at thrivent.com/retirement. And by Reuters, delivering news and information that reaches over a billion people every day. Before it's news, it's Reuters.
A summer blockbuster brings us this week's Marketplace Money buzzword, Russell 2000. Sounds like a movie title, but the Russell 2000 plays an important role in a world of prudent investment strategies. It's an important stock market index. Every year around this time, analysts change its cast of securities. That's when some traders try to make a quick buck. They'll buy shares they bet will be added to the index, hoping to drive up the price. But this year, analysts did things differently and added fewer stocks than expected. Those eager traders lost big time. Just proves messing with the market can be murder.
Got a box full of letters. Think you might like to read.
I'm Tess Vigeland, and this is the time in the show where we turn to our economics expert, Chris Farrell, and ask him all sorts of interesting things. Hey, Chris.
Hey, Tess. How are you doing?
Doing well. Let's see. So, interesting things. What is the square root of 2,548?
I'll get back to you on that.
Oh, that's not very interesting, actually. So let's skip that one and get right to the questions. But before please take down our website address. It's marketplace.org and click on the contact button. Or you can give us a call. It's 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONY. And our first caller is Diane from Rolla, Missouri. Hi, Diane.
Hi.
What do you do there in Missouri?
Well, I'm a counselor at the local university, University of Missouri, Rolla.
Oh, terrific. But I understand you are not originally from Rolla.
I am not. I am a native New Orleanian.
So what are your thoughts these days about what's going on there?
Well, my husband and I and my son have visited quite a few times. The progress is very, very slow, but it is happening.
And your parents are still there, right?
My parents are in the area, and they lost their home in Katrina. They lived in Chalmette in St. Bernard Parish, and my question is really related to them.
All right. So what's their current situation?
Their situation is rather tenuous. They live in an apartment, and my dad, unfortunately, has had a series of falls and illnesses since Katrina, and he's in a nursing home. And in a week, my mother will have to start using her retirement, her cash reserves that she saved to pay for the nursing home, because my dad has exhausted his Medicare just about.
Wow. This is not a good situation, Chris.
No, this is not. I have a couple of suggestions. First, consult and work with what's called an elder law attorney. And there's a National Academy of Elder Law Attorneys, and they specialize in this kind of situation. And their website is naela.com. Strikes me that we're going to be dealing potentially with Medicaid.
Right.
And Medicaid helping to pay for the nursing home. And one of the reasons why I'm saying working with an elder law attorney is that with Medicaid, there are a lot of restrictions about assets and income.
Correct. I know right now my mother has been so stressed by all of this. She hasn't known which way to turn. So I'm the information-seeking person.
And that's a real help. Unfortunately, the information is complicated. And when you go to – anyone who goes to the Medicaid website has a headache fairly quickly.
Right.
The language is not that friendly. It's not that usable. So it's really valuable. And for anyone who's listening to this program, I mean, one of the big contributions any child can make toward their elderly parents – is gather information, because it's stressful, it takes a lot of time, and it really takes, you know, asking a lot of questions and being relatively obnoxious.
Absolutely. And I'm more than assertive. And my mother is also very assertive and very strong, but she's really been beat down by taking care of my dad and then the worry about what she's going to do. You know, Chris, my other question is this. They still own a piece of property, but it's a shell of a house. They don't really know what to do with it. They do not want to live there. It's been flooded, you know, terribly, 18 feet of water. And is that going to count against them?
Well, no. I mean, the way the Medicaid laws are written, there's a tension with Medicaid between, is the taxpayer supported for the elderly and for low-income folks. And therefore, if you have assets that would like those assets to go, contribute toward taking care in their nursing home. The big exempt asset is the home, particularly for the spouse, as long as the spouse continues to live in the home. Now, because of Hurricane Katrina, they've made some adjustments in the rules because of Hurricane Katrina.
Okay.
So that's definitely an angle to pursue. My own suspicion would be that's all going to be fine. That's all going to be protected. But again, that's why I would turn toward an expert. But the way, at least from my ignorant eye, looking at the rules, should be okay.
Okay, good. That sounds, at least we have some hope and a place to go to start researching.
All right. Well, thanks for the call, Diane, and best of luck to you guys.
Thank you very much.
Take care. All right, Chris, let's reach into the email bag. And Mike is writing in from Grants Pass, Oregon, a fellow Oregonian. And he and his wife own a timeshare in Florida. They have to pay about $700 a year in fees for that timeshare. It initially cost them about $10,000, and that's all paid for. But in 2005, it was severely damaged in a hurricane. Here we are, hurricane country again. And although it's almost fully repaired and operational now, they're now having to pay a special $1,400 assessment for what the insurance didn't cover after the hurricane. Here's the question.
They're getting a little sick of all this. Is it possible to get out of owning a timeshare? They're considering even just giving it back because it's such a pain.
Well, I hate to be a bearer of bad news, but boy, the supply-demand situation in the timeshare market is tough, and they are very difficult to sell.
Ugh.
Now, you can get rid of them. You are not necessarily condemned for the rest of your life to own this asset that you don't want to own. I think that they've actually crossed the psychological hurdle that they're going to take a loss.
Yeah.
So a couple things that you can do. Find out what places are going at, what price they're going for in this particular community or in timeshares around that community because you want to price it to sell. You want to work with a legitimate broker. That's another avenue to go. You don't want to work with someone who's going to say, you know, give me a couple $100s and then I'm just going to do a little bit of advertising and you never hear from them again. A lot of people are in this situation, but as long as you're willing to take a loss, usually what I've seen tested is you're going to take a 30 to 50% loss and accept the fact that you're going to sell it for less than you bought it.
All right. So there you go, Mike. And sounds like you'll be spending a lot more time in Grants Pass, which is not an altogether bad thing. I will tell you that. It's a beautiful place. You know, sometimes vacations are just no fun at all. So if you ever need a financial getaway plan, we're happy to be your tour guides to the land of wealth. Click on the contact button on our website. It's marketplace.org. Call us at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY, and we spell that M-O-N-Y. All right, how about caller number two? Dende is on the phone from Corona, California. Hi, Dende.
How you doing?
Very well, and you?
Doing good.
Excellent. What do you do there in Corona?
I manage two clinics. I'm pretty much kind of like a clinical administrator.
Health clinics?
Yes.
Oh, how'd you get into healthcare?
I have a lot of family members, aunts and uncles, who are either doctors or registered nurses, and just a lot of family members in the healthcare. So it's kind of fell on my lap, I guess.
Well, I understand from my notes here that you've managed to save $50,000.
Yeah, with the help of others and just being very frugal.
What are you planning to do with it?
Oh, that's the part I kind of need a little advice on. I was thinking maybe half of it or maybe a little bit more than half of it into buying a home. And then the other half I want to put into stocks, mutual funds.
Do you have a retirement account yet?
No, I don't. That was something else that kind of came to my mind. Maybe, you know, starting a 401k.
Is there one offered by your employer?
No.
Okay.
No, there's not.
All right. Well, Chris, I'm going to do a little mind meld with you right now and guess that I think I'm going to hear the word Roth IRA coming out of your mouth.
That's exactly what I was thinking. I think the Roth IRA would be a terrific way to get a retirement plan going. And then that would also allow you to go ahead, start looking, and over a period of time, purchase a home. Because I think one of the ways a lot of us sort of build our finances over time is home ownership. Plus, for most of us, although I don't accept that, you know, renting means you're just throwing your money away. But there comes a point in time where we do want to put our money towards something that we own rather than a landlord. But I would strongly encourage you about starting a retirement account.
If I was going to do it, I would have to kind of just go up and do it on my own, which I have no problems with. I don't really know too much about the Roth. We call it a Roth IRA.
Yeah, Chris, let's go ahead and talk about some of the difference there. Is a 401k is really offered through an employer, and a Roth is something that you can pick up just as an individual.
That's right. With the IRA, you're putting in pre-tax dollars. When you withdraw the money in retirement, that's when you pay your taxes, ordinary income tax rates. With the Roth IRA, you're putting in after-tax dollars, but when you withdraw it in retirement, you pay no tax on the earnings.
Okay. Let's say I'm not really looking towards long run. What if I'm just trying to really just cash in within the next 5 years? That means I'm going to have to get into some really risky.
Not necessarily. I mean, 5 years is still relatively long term, wouldn't you say, Chris?
Yeah. I mean, if you're going to be cashing something in within a five-year time frame, which is actually would be my dividing line, I would lean toward a more conservative posture. And what you want are securities that are going to give you a decent income and at the same time, you know, preserve the value of your principal. So you have $50,000. So you put it into U.S. Treasury bills. Over 5 years, it's going to grow. Now you just say to Chris, I want to take a little more risk than that. So then I'll say, well, let's take a look at some high dividend paying stocks. Now, what does that mean? High dividend paying stock, a dividend is a payment that a company makes to you periodically and you're sharing in the profits. Those dividends, that's a nice chunk of change. Take a little more risk, still earn some money, and in a five-year time horizon, that's a reasonable risk to take. It's that way of thinking about things.
Does that help you out, Dende?
Yes, it does. It does. Thank you guys for the help.
Take care.
All right.
Well, it just goes to show it's never too late to start thinking about retirement. And if you've got questions, we've got answers. Give us a call. We'll shed some light on it. It's 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY, M-O-N-Y. Or just hop on over to our website. We're at marketplace.org. Click on the contact button. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. All right, one more reach into the email bag. Maria writes in from Mason, Michigan, and she and her husband are in a debt management program. So far, they've managed to pay off about 30% of their collective debt. Now, they're really excited about that, Chris, but they're still living very lean, and this summer they're going to have to add student loan payments of about $500 per month. Question, are there any alternatives to the debt management program that they can look into other than bankruptcy?
You know, they're doing what they need to do. I would just say keep on doing what they're doing. It takes time to add on this debt. It takes time to get rid of it. If they did go into bankruptcy, by the way, just to add a point, student loan debt cannot be discharged in bankruptcy. So, you know, I would say bravo to them. Congratulations. There are a lot of people in similar circumstances. In terms of the student loan debt, if it's federal student loan debt, there's a lot of flexibility built into that.
So you could get yourself some lower payments.
Just get yourself some lower payments. You can get essentially a step program where it starts out really low and then gradually builds up in time under the theory that if you've invested in your education, maybe you're not making much money initially, but over time you'll get a return to that education, so you'll be able to make bigger payments farther down the road.
How do they do that? How do they go about getting a lower payment on their student loans? Do they just call up Sallie Mae?
Well, the first thing that they would do is go to the Department of Education and just sort of look at their student aid section. You then call whoever your student lender is, and you get their information about what they offer, what's the process. And remember, don't be hesitant to do it. They understand there's a lot of students right now that are really struggling. And boy, that's how I would buy myself some breathing room, some time to enjoy life at the same time, and then be able to be more aggressive about the student loan debt later on.
All right. Well, those are all the questions we can take on this week's show. Thanks so much for all of them. But do leave your question for a future program on our voicemail. Call 1-877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY, M-O-N-Y. Or visit the contact page on our website, marketplace.org. Thanks so much, Chris.
Thanks, Des.
Hoping to sue over a bad investment? The Supreme Court's making it tougher. And if you've ever thought of donating an old computer?
If you're totally comfortable with every website you've visited, every email you've written or received being available to whoever might get it, go ahead.
Or maybe not. That's coming up on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Tess Viglund. All right, I've got 30 seconds before this message will self-destruct, so here goes. Think about what you've got on your computer's hard drive. Personal emails, financial records, maybe a few web pages you wouldn't want anyone to know about. Well, it's none of my business, but when you get rid of that computer, it's not like the movies where the information just vanishes. Jeff Brumfield reports on the mission almost impossible of getting rid of the data.
If you're like me, you keep a lot of private stuff on your computer, and you've probably never thought too much about what happens to it all when you delete it. But before you sell that old machine, maybe you should.
Your computer and everything else is just a giant piece of copying technology, right? So everything is meant to be backed up and stored, and if you lose it, they want you to be able to find it.
David McGuire is with the nonprofit Center for Democracy and Technology. It seeks to preserve privacy in the electronic age.
It's not something inherently malicious about technology. It's just that often your data persists even when you think you've gotten rid of it.
And that means when you get rid of that old computer, someone else may be able to get your data off it. In 2003, MIT computer scientists bought 158 hard drives from people who thought they were empty. But researchers found over 5,000 credit card numbers and sensitive records and several gigabytes worth of personal email and pornography. In the corporate world, a cottage industry has sprung up to deal with the risks of obsolete data. It's called data destruction.
What is risk? Webster defines it as possibility of loss or injury. The kind of risk we are talking about is e-risk. Specifically, risk to privacy and security are at the top. Your company may also experience financial fines, fiduciary challenges, bad press, prison terms, sanctions, and of course, environmental and health challenges. Do you know what your e-risks really are?
I went to the nation's largest government technology conference where I met Charles Smith, inventor of something called the hard drive crusher.
This is taking about 7 seconds. We're watching all the platters get mashed up so that they're unreadable. Now we release. We have just prevented the escape of data.
Smith's machine is basically just a hydraulic ram that can be used to crush hard drives, cell phones, memory sticks, and, well, anything you might want crushed. Seemed a little extreme to crush my hard drive before selling my computer, until he put it in perspective.
You seem like a very nice guy, and if you're totally comfortable with every website you've visited, every email you've written or received being available to whoever might get it, go ahead.
Every website? Maybe it would be a good idea to pulverize my hard drive before I sell my next machine. But not all your sensitive data is on your hard disk. Maybe you're keeping old tax records on CD? Well, before you snap them in two and toss them in the trash, talk to this guy.
My name is Dr. Roger Hutchison, and I'm the inventor of the technology used by the National Security Agency to destroy classified data on CD-ROM and DVD discs.
Hutchison says it's possible to read up to 85% of data off a shredded CD. Instead, he suggests his CD destroyer.
In 9 seconds out, and at the end of the process, if you take a microscope and try to image the data, it's 100% gone.
And these guys weren't the only ones at the show. Others were peddling self-destructing flash drives and disk demagnetizers. There's even a company that will reduce your entire computer to a pile of dust through its patented destruction process. All this crushing and grinding doesn't come cheap. Most companies decline to give exact prices, but Charles Smith says his hard drive crusher costs over $11,000. So what can the average consumer do? David McGuire has come up with one solution.
Unfortunately, the pretty inefficient way that I've gone about it so far is I just haven't thrown any computers away. I've got them in a pile in my closet.
If you're lacking closet space, then McGuire suggests taking matters into your own hands with a carefully swung hammer. In Washington, I'm Jeff Brumfield for Marketplace Money.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thriven Financial for Lutherans, working to provide tools and expertise to help you meet your retirement goals and ultimately thrive in retirement. Let's thrive. On the web at thrivent.com/retirement.
If you're a corporate executive, it's been a good year for Supreme Court decisions. If you're an investor, not so much. In the most recent ruling, investors claimed a technology company called Tell Labs gave a false picture of demand for its products in order to boost its stock price. The court said the lawsuit could only go forward if there was compelling evidence of the company's intent to rip off investors. Joining us with the details is Eric Talley, a professor of law at Berkeley. Eric, what's the difference now?
Well, now to bring one of these suits forward, a shareholder investor has to be able to claim that the story she's telling, connecting the facts to the fraud, is a compelling story. It's at least as believable as other more innocent interpretations of those facts.
So it sounds to me like the Supreme Court is saying that a company can respond to a lawsuit that accuses it of fraud by saying, hey, you know what? I didn't know this was going on. And that then the investors who are suing have to have a good case that says, no, they actually did know.
That's exactly right. And one of the important things about this opinion is that it front loads this inquiry. Usually that's something that gets argued out anyway when you get to litigation. But now this is going to be right out of the starting blocks in a lawsuit. And so the shareholders are going to have to fend off a bunch of these potential excuses. It's going to give defendants or the companies a large incentive to try to make more of these plausible excuses, again, right at the time the complaint is filed.
Does that mean that an investor is really going to have a smoking gun?
It certainly suggests that some investors aren't going to be able to go forward where they might have been able to go forward before. The court didn't go as far as saying you have to have an absolute dead center smoking gun. All it said is that it has to be as good as any other story. Most of these cases will end up going forward. But the far-fetched, fanciful story is probably not going to pass muster anymore after this ruling.
So what does this ruling mean to, for example, cases that we've heard about for the last several years with Enron and WorldCom, Adelphia, where investors are trying to get back some of the enormous amounts of money that were lost in those frauds?
Well, cases that are still alive are still probably going to be able to use this Supreme Court case. But one of the things to remember about recent shareholder litigation, particularly the big cases, they're complex cases. There are a lot of theories at play, and the likelihood that it's going to be something other than a tie actually is probably smaller than you think. A lot of times when judges confront a fairly complex set of facts, they might just want to learn more and declare it a tie and say, let's go forward into discovery.
What does this most recent ruling, this Tell Labs ruling, tell us about where the court comes down on investors versus the companies that they're investing in? There was a case, I believe, a few weeks ago where the justices essentially said that the banks that were underwriting all of the dot-com IPOs back in the 90s weren't responsible for the fact that some of those dot-coms went under.
I think it's fair to interpret this terms court opinions being somewhat more friendly towards companies and less friendly to at least the shareholders who are making complaints. But this is a complex terrain. Remember, meritless lawsuits cost all sorts of investors money because it's the companies that ultimately have to pay for them, and it gets taken out of the shareholders' return. So in some sense, shareholders are probably rooting for a rule that roots out meritless cases. On the other hand, it may also weed out a number of meritorious cases, ones that really had value and that could have deterred insiders at companies from perpetrating frauds.
Is it fair to say with these recent rulings that the court seems to be sticking it to the little guy?
It's hard to say. I think that there is a sense in which the court's view is that litigation is expensive, and that not only hurts the big guy, but it may hurt the little investor as well. So I think there are some people who would say this may not be too harmful to the little guy. On the other hand, you have to believe a particular story about the effects of litigation and smaller investors. How you interpret that fact, again, is something that's still part of the public debate and probably isn't resolved.
Eric Talley is co-director of the Berkeley Center of Law, Business, and the Economy. Eric, thanks as always for helping parse this out for us.
It was a pleasure as always.
Remember that Fox show, Who Wants to Marry a Millionaire? That's so 7 years ago. These days, you are no one unless your betrothed has at least 9 zeros before the decimal point in his or her bank statement. Love is great, but money is fabulous. At least that seems to be the message in the latest issue of Money Magazine. The headline says it all. How to Marry a Billionaire. Ka-ching! Marlis Harris is the author, and she joins us. Hi, Marlis.
Hi.
All right, let's get one thing out of the way. Is this story a joke?
Well, everybody asks that. And what I have to tell you is that there are about 900 billionaires in the entire world. So your odds are pretty low. So I don't think we were that serious.
And as you point out in the story itself, this is not what you'd call a politically correct way of going about finding a mate.
No, it isn't at all. And I've actually received a lot of verging on hate mail about the story.
Well, let's just go ahead and go through the story and see what you found. What are the chances at this point of finding yourself a rich man or woman to marry?
They're very low if you really have to have a billionaire. But there are lots of 100 millionaires and up.
That would do, wouldn't it?
I think so. That's why I tell people to lower their sights perhaps a little bit. There are a lot of people out there who are achieving, you know, 300, 400 million. And there are ex-wives and ex-husbands and heirs and heiresses. So while it's not, you know, something I would stake my life on, I think it's doable.
One of the tips that you provide is that often these relationships, when men and women meet their potential partner who is just happens to be a millionaire or billionaire, it's at work.
That's right. Mainly because the billionaire has a type A plus personality and is always at the office. And so he's not going to go on the, you know, the church or synagogue hayride. He doesn't have time, you know, as his mother probably told him to meet somebody. I suggest that you get an MBA degree, because nobody really knows what MBAs do, so you can get hired almost anywhere. And, you know, you can go for the hedge fund or the investment banking group or whatever, and that should put you in the right milieu.
All right, Marlis, I have to ask you, have you followed any of your own advice here?
Well, I married so young and I was so stupid. My mother's been lamenting ever since. In fact, when she read this article, she was tearful at the lost opportunity. But no, I married someone really quite ordinary.
And you're perfectly happy.
Well, I don't know about perfect. I always say there's one thing missing from our marriage, and that is money. But otherwise, we'd be perfectly happy.
Marlis Harris is the senior editor at Money Magazine, and her article, How to Marry a Billionaire, is in the July issue. Thanks so much.
I enjoyed it.
This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media.
White House officials say the president
and the experts say usually
the Heritage Foundation estimates
it's like it's going to be the best quarter.
They decide what they're going to
charge. That has some veterans nervous.
Time once again for our economics editor, Chris Farrell, to help you sort out what's smart, what's stupid, and what's the straight story. And Chris, you know, it seems to me the implosion that we're seeing in the subprime mortgage market really can be described as a tragedy, don't you think?
Oh, I do. And I share your anger about this. I mean, lots of low-income folks, minorities, they were sold a piece of the American dream. But in order to get home ownership, they took these mortgages that were complex, they were opaque, just bad mortgages.
Well, to try to deal with that, we've heard about this program in Illinois where they came up with the idea of mandatory counseling
right.
for borrowers who are getting a mortgage. The state would actually provide this counseling. And that certainly seems sensible to me, but it's blown up into this huge controversy.
Well, it has. The program focused on low-income Black and Hispanic neighborhoods, and there was a charge that this was the new redlining. So to stem that charge, according to a story in the New York Times, the program will be expanded, or at least that's the proposal that's out there. Nevertheless, mortgage brokers, real estate agents, they're still opposed to the program because it slowed down sales.
And specifically slows down commissions on those sales.
Ah, yes. So here's the straight story. Financial literacy education is a good tool for reducing predatory lending, period.
Do you think that it could go so far as to eliminate predatory lending? I mean, if people are really educated about the mortgages that they're getting.
No, I think that's asking too much of financial literacy. Let me just give you an example. I was driving in Memphis in some low-income neighborhoods with a group of people from RISE, the RISE Foundation, and what they did was teach financial literacy in public housing. And it was to enable people to go from public housing, own their own home. And one of the things that they focused on were these rapid refund loans.
The tax refund, yeah.
Exactly. Well, they explain why this is a bad deal. And it is a bad deal. Nevertheless, some people were outraged and they no longer did it. Other people said, you know, I still need the money now. And they would do it. So you're not going to eliminate people taking bad mortgages. But look, you're going to cut it down a lot, and that's what you want to do.
Is there any evidence out there that programs like this one in Illinois with this mandatory state counseling, that they actually work?
You know, there's a lot of programs out there. I mean, the military has programs. There's lots of nonprofit foundations that are out there. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac used to have some programs. They work somewhat. Some people benefit, and in general, no one gets harmed by these programs. So if you sort of say, okay, one law of policymaking is first do no harm. Okay, where's the harm except for, as you've mentioned, you might cut slow down on commissions. I don't care about the industry. I care about the consumer. So first you do no harm, and there are some signs that you do some good. So I'm in favor of these programs. I can't see what the problem is here, and I don't care.
if mortgage brokers and real estate agents aren't making as much money as they were before. That's not the customer. The customer is the borrower that is being taken advantage of by slick operators who have sold them and still want to sell them a bad product.
All right, Chris, I'm looking forward to you trying to get a real estate agent when you try to sell your house. But
it'll be sale by owner.
You know, another big objection to this program is that it's mandatory, putting us into, you know, the nanny state. Does that bother you at all?
You know, I've been trying to get bothered by it. Often it's an argument that I am somewhat sympathetic to. But I can't get worked up about it. And I think the reason why I can't is that I think the world has changed. This is part of a much bigger issue. Personal finance is no longer, you know, a tributary of our lives. Personal finance is really a big part of our lives. Think about what we talk about, Tess, you know, with credit cards and all the issues surrounding credit cards and 401ks and, you know, the move toward health savings accounts. Mm-hmm. Financial literacy is a must, not an option. These people are not in school. They have jobs. So you can't just say, well, let's start teaching them in the schools, which I would propose. This is what do you do for the people now taking on the biggest financial obligation of their lives. With that little bit of knowledge, you help out some people, and some people are going to make a more sensible decision for them and their families. And I say that's exactly a good thing.
All right. The Straight Story from our man, Chris Farrell. Chris, thanks as always.
Thanks.
And that's Marketplace Money for this week. Next time, we're searching for a new word, something to describe life after 60.
Now we're seeing a large number of people come up to a point where they finish their midlife work, but they're not going to be old for 20, 25, 30 years, a period as long as midlife in duration, and they're not in any way going to approximate the notion of being elderly.
Marketplace Money is produced by Wendy Sykes and Nancy Fargali, with Rico Galliano, James Richter, Stephen Hoffman, Michelle Phillippe, and the rest of the Marketplace staff. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yore. Remember, talk to your own expert before you make any big money decisions. I'm Tess Vigeland. We'll see you next week.
Want to hear something on Marketplace Money again? Help is as near as your home computer. To find audio archives of past programs and information on transcripts, just go to the internet and log on to our website. The information you need when you need it is only a few clicks away. Just point your browser to marketplace.org. Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, working to provide tools and expertise to help you meet your retirement goals and ultimately thrive in retirement. Let's thrive. On the web at thrivent.com/retirement.
American Public Media.